from Chicago. This is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Art Sear, Robert Pape, and Ryan Yantis. Our program tonight coming to you from my home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you want to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. If you want to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video all the time at beyondthebeltway.com. If you're missing the show, wherever you are, you can watch it live. And, again, we keep it in the archives for a long, long time. We will be discussing later in this broadcast the very disturbing events of Charlottesville, Virginia, later in the broadcast. However, the big story prior to that, obviously, was a discussion this week of North Korea and the fiery rhetoric presented by the President of the United States. We're going to be talking about that for most of the broadcast this evening, and let's begin with a little review of some things that Donald Trump said last week from the White House.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
And he's not going to threaten the United States, and he's not going to threaten Japan, and he's not going to threaten South Korea. No, that's not a dare, as you say. That is a statement of fact.
A long time, for many years. And it's about time that somebody stuck up for the people of this country and for the people of other countries. So, if anything, maybe that statement wasn't tough enough.
I stand corrected. That was not at the White House. That was at the golf course where the president has conducted a lot of important statements over the last several months. Art Sear from Carthage College, you join us tonight. Thank you very much for being with us. Your reaction to the rhetoric from the president last week.
I think it's most unfortunate. There are very good reasons why presidents of the United States and other serious, responsible, great nations don't talk that way. If you're an old-time totalitarian dictatorship or some tin-pot banana republic or some poverty-stricken dictatorship somewhere in a godforsaken part of the world, you're trying to get attention. But it's most unfortunate that the president chooses to address himself this way.
Robert Pape from the University of Chicago joins us.
I think we should be clear. President Trump is making nuclear threats against North Korea. He is threatening to respond to what North Korea does, not in a proportionate way. He is threatening to use nuclear weapons on North Korea. This is not quite unprecedented in American history. During the Korean War in 1953, President Eisenhower also used nuclear threats against both North Korea and China. But that was a long time ago under completely different circumstances.
Completely different.
We have not seen this kind of reckless, threatening behavior by an American president certainly since then.
Ryan Yantis also joins us. He is a lieutenant colonel, U.S. Army retired. And Ryan, our colonel, your reaction to the president's comments?
I concur. A little too much hyperbole from the president. I would appreciate a little more moderation on his approach. One of the challenges in coming from the business world and suddenly being thrust into the world of diplomacy is understanding that the slightest nuance can make a huge difference. Mr. Trump's learning curve is going to be steep in this regard, and he's got to learn that he's not negotiating with Teamsters to have something done, but he's doing international team building and consensus building.
I can hear many, many listeners to this program or viewers of the program tonight shouting back at the television set and saying, basically, we've had administration after administration, at least four of them in a row, that have talked diplomatically, and we have been outmaneuvered by North Korea because we didn't have strong words like this. Everything was, I'll use the term, namby-pamby diplomatic BS, and that's where we are today. And frankly, the promise of rhetoric like that is what Donald Trump, that's what got him to the White House. So I guess my question to you is it possible that Donald Trump could be right and you guys are wrong. Art Sir.
It's possible. It's not likely. I don't believe North Korea has ever outmaneuvered us. Dwight Eisenhower, at the other end of the spectrum, from my point of view, from President Trump, put in place and achieved, through the most brutal means as well as complex diplomacy, a ceasefire that has held since 1953. It's a stable situation. One of the great successes of American foreign policy is South Korea. Our Korean friends have done it, but the U.S. provided the protection and the development aid, again, through comprehensive, and I mean thorough, planning by General as well as President Eisenhower. We're doing quite well in the Korean Peninsula.
There's a difference between being tough and being reckless.
And being a bully.
Being reckless is taking risks with hundreds of thousands of lives. Nuclear war, nuclear attack, whether started by us or by North Korea, would be very so devastating. It would make the Iraq war that we've just lived through look like a walk in the park. Seoul has 10 million people. Tokyo has 10 million people. These are not far from North Korea. They are not far from North Korea's reach. This is not unimaginable technologically for North Korea to reach. For Donald Trump to be moving into this world in a reckless fashion, he is not fully in control of the situation. He is going down a road that he cannot fully control, where hundreds of thousands of people's lives could be at risk.
Colonel, is there a way, again, these are for the armchair generals out there who listen to talk radio and watch shows like this. Is there any military way where our initial attack against or strike against them could be so massive that we would stop their ability to retaliate against South Korea or against Japan or against Guam?
In a hypothetical, it's possible. What's the possibility, your percentage chance? And I would say that that's very, very slim. First, let's go back 16 years, September 11th. We had, in September 11th, 2001, we had a very determined, ideologically different opponent from ourselves. And they were very clear in their stated goals and objectives, and they had the intent to hurt us and hurt the West. And what we lacked was a depth of imagination, and we didn't give them due in what they had the capability of doing. They couldn't build a bomb big enough to bring down the World Trade Center. They couldn't bring in enough weapons, so they stole a peaceful means of conveyance, and by its use weaponized it and flew innocent men, women, and children not only into the World Trade Centers but into the Pentagon. And the only thing that stopped that series of attacks was not the military, was not law enforcement. It was the FAA saying, clear the skies, everything lands now. And that took that platform out of use.
When we come back, by the way, we should mention that you were at the Pentagon on 9/11.
No.
I want to talk about that at some point as the program unfolds this evening. 1-800-723-8289, wherever you're listening. You've heard a lot of hot rhetoric from the President of the United States. Your reaction to the rhetoric last week on North Korea. 1-800-723-8289. 8289, I'm Bruce Dumont. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Our guest this evening, all basically very upset with the comments of the President of the United States, to say the least. So again, if you're a phone caller out there and want to respond, 1-800-723-8289. I want to ask another question, though, because you've talked about, you know, the rhetoric that he has stated. In his national security team of H.R. McMaster and General Mattis and Rex Tillerson and Nikki Haley over at the United Nations, do you think any of those four people would be able to talk him out of striking North Korea or not?
Question for me, Bruce?
Yeah, I'll start with you, Ryan.
All right. The one thing that I'm resting more easily with is we have words, and I think it was Churchill who said it's better to jaw, jaw, jaw than war, war, war.
Yeah.
And right now what we have is a situation where there is no strategic alert as far as there's been no recall of troops, there's been no positioning the U.S. Army Korea, the Pacific Command, are conducting normal routine operations. There's enhanced vigilance, but there's no stepping up of capabilities beyond the normal day-to-day. So, well, my preference is more the speak softly and carry a big stick methodology of presidential leadership and build that consensus. We don't have precipitous actions that match the sometimes bombastic terms.
Bob?
Bruce, I have tremendous respect for General Kelly. He was at my conference in May, the University of Chicago. I had a conference with my center, the Chicago Project on Security and Threats, and he came for an hour. I spent time with him. I also spent time with General Mattis. I have tremendous respect for them. You see them effectively trying to pull back the president's rhetoric in the last few days. That said, President Trump is the president of the United States. He's made very, very clear that if he disagrees with people who are subordinate to him, the subordinates go. So this is not a situation where they can actually contain President Trump. They can give him advice. They can give him suggestions. I believe what you're seeing is more than suggestions. They're General Mattis himself is making statements that are different than the president's, calmer than the president's. At the end of the day, though, we have to remember President Trump is the president.
Let me ask you. I want to get your reaction to follow up, then get everybody's response. Do you think those in the chain of command would follow the order of the president if he ordered a strike? Knowing these people, as you say, you know a couple of them personally, do you think they would follow a direct order from President Trump to strike North Korea?
I think that there would be sufficient obedience of that rule that it would happen. I can't say for sure that you would have no insubordination. I think but that is showing you, Bruce, the level of the confrontation we're at. So that just the very fact you're even asking the question shows just the kind of reckless territory that the president has opened the door.
Art, your answer to the same question, would the leadership of the National Security Team and the Pentagon, do you think they would follow the order of the president if he ordered the strike?
A nuclear strike?
Yes.
Now, under what we know? No, I don't. Two points that I at least find reassuring. I hope some other people do as well. There is not a nuclear button on the president's desk that he can push and launch missiles and bombers, although Lyndon Johnson liked to talk as though he did when he was in the White House. We also have the 25th Amendment to the Constitution. After the tragic assassination of President Kennedy, how do you plan for tragedy on certain circumstances? I think if the president demonstrated through trying to act as opposed to constant talk that he were, in fact, demented, he would be removed. That's what I think. And Colonel Yandis is absolutely right. We have professional military people in the White House. We should emphasize professional and in the senior levels of the government, emphasize professional as well as military. These people do know what they're doing.
But are you saying that?
Yeah, no. Answer,
okay,
not easy for me. No,
that's for sure. Well, I'm going to give you another one. Maybe that's got a short answer to it as well.
Okay,
and that is, are you suggesting that if the president ordered such a strike, you would view him as demented?
Yes, I would at the current time. I don't see him as a businessman. He's a show businessman, which is a demanding line of work, so I'm told. But he talks. He acts in terms of bullying and lawsuits, but he's not a person of action in the outside world. He's a show business personality who became president of the United States, which is something for all of us, you and me and everyone, to think about.
Colonel Yantis, I have a question to you. Do you think that those in the chain of command would follow his orders if he ordered a strike?
I think that there's enough safeguards within that process.
Right.
And there's the essentially, the two keys required to arm the system, whether that's codes or physical keys. And it starts at the national capital, the command authority, and then permeates out through the chains of commands in the strategic arms.
Without giving any secrets away.
No, it's not secrets.
Describe that process for us. If the president woke up one day and said, damn it, I'm going to strike, t- Take us through the process. What happens?
Well, and Bruce, my knowledge of this, I'm not an expert on that aspect of strategic weapons, but it is a two-person control process where each person has to independently enter in the code to give the authorization. It takes the two voices saying, do this now, and we have concurrence. There's also requirements for congressional notification. There's the whole issue of continuity of government. One of the things on the morning of September 11th, and I'm going back to 16 years ago, you know, Mr. Rumsfeld being taken from the Pentagon when he very much wanted to be on the ground helping, and he was taken off to a remote site because the continuity plan said if somebody attacks in the National Capital Region, they need to go operate out of a remote site separate from the Capital Region.
But we should be clear that if the military refuses this order, that is not just a minor insubordination where the president wakes up the next day and he's the president. They have effectively toppled the president. So what this is about is much, much more serious in a constitutional sense and in a continuity of government sense. And I think that this is going to weigh very, very heavily on senior military leaders as they go forward. So this is not a situation of simply the mid-levels of the bureaucracy turning the keys. This is a matter of whether or not the president is going to be obeyed on national security affairs.
Let's move on. Table this important for a while. Point. We'll get. Did you want to make a
point? No, just a very important point.
No, very important point. Yeah. My next question is because there's already begun to enter itself into the national dialogue is whether or not a North Korea. It's not okay, but we can survive with the North Korea. We survived with a nuclear Pakistan. We've survived with other nuclear powers. We just find a way to work around them. Does anybody at this table believe that that's a viable, reliable strategy to use? Art?
Yes. It's worked since 1953. A fact to keep in mind is that the armistice has held since 1953.
That's there's the been armistice.
Violence and incidents.
I'm just saying a
and
fully...
And Pyongyang formally rejected the armistice, but nothing has happened.
Let me fine-tune it then. If North Korea continues to test and demonstrate that it has capabilities to weaponize a missile that could hit any part of the United States or the western part of the middle or Chicago, do you believe that a nation that has that power with a leader that is currently in place, do you think that is a nation that should go unchallenged in some way to make sure it never, ever happens?
Yes, they should not go unchallenged. Yes, we should challenge them. And there comes in not only diplomacy, but imagination. Stuxnet, American, Israeli, very possibly British intelligence, worked together on a fantastic, still-secret computer worm that messed up the Iran nuclear program. Throughout the Cold War, when we were facing a much more dangerous adversary than we are in North Korea, a series of them, and when we came much closer to nuclear conflagration than any time before or since during the missile crisis in Cuba, in October of 1962, we encouraged cultural and educational exchanges. We brought about conventional arms reductions and strategic arms reductions with the Soviets. I don't think we should be taking the lead. I think we should encourage our South Korean friends to take the lead. And there are lots of opportunities, and I think President Moon, the new president, given his military experience, among other things, is in a very good position to pursue these kinds of things to try to defuse the situation. That's a proven strategy, Mr. Dumont.
And I would like to add that until this last week, the Trump administration had been following on the heels of the Obama administration and working with China to isolate North Korea. So the move at the UN, you mentioned Ambassador Haley, if we just roll back a week and before the bluster, the nuclear threats, we were in a situation where the Trump administration had worked successfully, and I believe Secretary Tillerson was behind this, had worked successfully to craft a resolution at the UN that China didn't not only not veto, they supported, which is against North Korea. Now,
and by the way, and their foreign minister followed up with rhetoric of his own the following day, basically saying,
yes,
you guys listen up to this. Don't mess with the international community.
Now let's roll in Trump's threats. What's happened to China just a day ago in the China Daily? This is the official paper of the government. They have now moved their position. Their position is North Korea, don't start it, but if Trump does, we're with you. That's a loss. That's behind where we were.
We should remind listeners, and then we're going to take calls when we come back. Last Sunday night on this program, the entire panel was congratulating the Trump administration for the way that Nikki Haley handled things at the UN, getting a 15-zip vote in the Security Council, which is unheard of. So, again, it's only a week, so tune in next week and stay with us tonight. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border.
Always
you're
listen to Beyond
to
the Bell.
Most exciting
every Sunday
show on Sunday. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us. I understand that a regular guest on this program, Chris Roebling, frequently sits in for me when I vacation. We have moved him to call as a listener. So, Chris Roebling, listening in Chicago. Go ahead. You're on the air.
It's rare. I think I may have called in one other. Good to be with you.
What moved you?
Appreciate your panel. Well, I think there are two really significant questions that are not yet addressed, and I submit these to your three eminent panelists. Number one is, why has American policy since the mid-90s, which has always been predicated on preventing North Korea's achievement of the nuclear weapons and the delivery system, why has that, all of those policies, all of those actions, why has that all failed such that we are where we are? And the second question is...
Chris, let's let him respond to the first question, and we're going to start with Art Sear.
I think our policy has worked in terms of containing North Korea outside of attacking the country militarily in a devastating way. There's no way we can prevent them from developing nuclear weapons. Bob Pape's colleague, John Mearsheimer, argues strongly that nuclear weapons are understandable and stabilizing. I'm not sure that I agree with that point of view, but I think it's worth considering and discussing. It doesn't mean general war just because North Korea has, at this point, rudimentary nuclear weapons. I try to describe what I think we should be doing to undercut their system. An important example, in line with your concerns, in 2010, Israel, working closely with the U.S., took out a nuclear development laboratory in Syria that was on the verge of actually manufacturing a nuclear weapon for the Syrian government. We are willing to act and do so. Is that clear?
I think that's right. I agree with Art. I would just add one thing. I think we've made a couple of erroneous assumptions across administrations. One assumption is that the Kim regimes do not have genuine support among the population,
right,
that it's manufactured support, it's sort of superficial and so forth. One of my colleagues at the University of Chicago, Bruce Cummings, is one of the eminent scholars of North Korea, and he strongly has been trying to suggest to multiple different administrations to take a more sincere look at the fact that since the Korean War, North Korea has been besieged, and it is natural for that population to look to its government, as awful as it is, as its main source of support. And this is something that I think that we as Americans find hard to accept, and I think multiple administrations have thought there is an easy wedge they can drive between the population and the government.
I want to go to Ryan and then get back to you, Chris. Go ahead, Colonel.
Great question, Chris. I think when I was in Korea in 1988, South Korea was just starting its renaissance, and it was seeking more political freedom and economic growth. North Korea was looked as the bully neighbor to the North, and then soon after, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, the opening of the West to the West, when that happened, North Korea not only caught a cold, it caught the flu, and combined that with a couple of years of very, very bad crop policies and droughts and then floods, Korea went through a horrific period. And there was a denigration of the North Korean people and the North Korean leadership. They were the Norks. They were you know, the Kim family crime syndicate, they can't do anything right. And there was a certain amount of Occidental bigotry that was applied at a international basis. And sure, they're going to build a nuke. What are they going to build it with? An ox cart and a bucket of rice? No. Well, guess what? Creative people behind bars can create weapons to hurt their guards. And that's what you have in North Korea.
Chris, did you get an answer to your question?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with eminent, you know, folks like your three panelists.
Is he being sarcastic?
I'm going to point out that, you know, we've got videotape. It's on the internet. We've had four presidents now, Clinton, Bush, Obama, and now Trump, and they all say the same thing, that U.S. policy has been directed at preventing Korea from getting nuclear weapons, and therefore the ineluctable conclusion, we have failed. Now, I want to go to the second, finally, and get off the phone and you guys get back to your program, but Mearsheimer or anybody else that with Kissinger, nuclear weapons and foreign policy in the 1950s,
yeah.
Everything about nuclear weapons depends on rational actors. And I believe that the statements by Trump, which I don't really like, ought to be seen in a context of dealing with an individual who apparently controls some nuclear weapons, whatever their delivery system, who is not a rational actor the way the Soviet Politburo was, the way the Chinese Politburo is, the way the guys in India and Pakistan and South Africa and Israel are, or France and UK. I mean, we are not going to dress up Kim Jong-un as a rational actor, and I believe the statements this week must be understood in that context,
Chris,
which is qualitatively different.
Let me ask you, though, if he is irrational, as you say, would you acknowledge that this irrational leader and his father, who also was equally irrational, maybe even a little less so, that these irrational leaders have been, I'll use the term outmaneuver, I know Art doesn't like that word, I mean, he's been dealing with rational people representing the United States and the free world, primarily the United States, for four decades now. And so he's still in power. He has nuclear power. He puts that, whenever time he has a missile launch, he puts it on TV. His people are, they think he's, you know, they don't know what the other side of the world is like. So they
Look,
think he's great.
He is a brilliant fiend. He is a brilliant fiend.
Yes,
as was his father. And anybody who sells the Korean people short on intelligence and determination, resolve and industriousness is gonna be on the wrong side of that expectation. The Korean people are brilliant. I mean, they're absolutely incredible. And we're dealing with a rogue nation that has outmaneuvered the United States. And I think we've probably got about 6 or 8 months in which to neutralize this threat, because otherwise we're going to be living with a Northeastern Asian security architecture that is badly tilted away from the interests of the United States.
Excuse me. What specifically do you want the United States government to do? Please be specific. What do you want us to do?
I agree with what. Look, I think it is time for creativity. I think it is time for intelligence operations. I think it is time for Stuxnet. I think it is time for extraordinarily harsh sanctions. I think it's time to penetrate the leadership cadre and to convince the generals that they're all going to get homes in Manila, Taiwan, Beijing, or wherever the heck they want, and all they have to do is get rid of this guy. I don't think that the regime is necessary. I agree with that the regime has generated local political support. I think that is absolutely true. I never doubted that, actually. What I think is important is that there are folks over there who do not want to become vaporized because Kim Jong-un is, you know, a kid who spent his college years drawing pictures of NBA players.
I want to ask a question of Bob. How we're talking about, we're reacting in the United States because there was a story a couple of months ago that they could hit the mainland, and whether it was Denver, Los Angeles, Seattle, all those cities have been mentioned,
Boston,
including Chicago and Boston and New York. So we're reacting, obviously, maybe overreacting. You know, people are calling for civil defense, you know, tests That was the recommendation to those living in Guam, which seemed a little 1950s response. But my question is, how are the people in Seoul, how are the people in Tokyo reacting? Are they frantic? I'm going to ask Bob Pate this. Are they frantic?
Well, I think what you see, so I have former students who are in Seoul as we speak. Don't really want to go into personal details with them. And what you see in email messages and so forth is a lot of gallows humor. And I think it's because they realize that they really have very little control. I would like to respond just and say that one of the things that's very helpful about this last exchange is it brings up a contradiction in the irrationality point. Some people are saying that North Korea is so irrational, we can't trust they won't use nuclear weapons, but therefore they're so able to not respond when we bluster and we push them and we egg them on. No, if they're so irrational that we can't trust they're using nuclear weapons, we should not be tickling the tiger. We should not be encouraging them to overreact. Either they are rational enough not to use nuclear weapons, or they're so irrational they will. We have to make a decision about that assumption. And what you see are people bouncing all over.
Well, okay. All right, let me just
last word to you, Chris. Go ahead.
Just real quick. You know, Potemkin was a brilliant statesman because he operated with four different foreign policies towards Poland at the same time. And I think you're dealing with a president and an administration that is beset by this issue, and especially by the leaked report of miniaturization capability that the Washington Post published on Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. That is the proximate cause of this conversation. And I think that they are working on four or five different levels at the same time, one of which is changing the perception in the leadership cadre that there is no resolve in the United States. I don't like the way that Trump speaks. I don't like the way he spoke this week. I wish he wouldn't speak the way that he does. There's no difference between me and you guys on that. What I'm trying to say is you're not acknowledging the failure of U.S. foreign policy in the Korean context.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I am back shortly, 1-800-723-8289. Let's go to calls. Let's go to the banks of the Mississippi River. Gary is listening to us in La Crosse, Wisconsin on WIZM. Go ahead.
Beautiful place.
Hey, yeah. I just got a couple of things I want to say.
Sure.
I think it's pretty much a no-brainer that one of the guests you have on said North Korea has not outwitted or outsmarted us. I mean, there's really no argument there. They have nuclear weapons. Yeah, I know. My point I want to make is we keep talking about Donald Trump, and we keep talking about, you know, his rhetorical speech and what he says. I honestly didn't even think about the fact that what he said I don't think anybody in their right mind honestly believes that what Trump says or what he doesn't say is going to cause Kim Jong-un to either launch or not launch missiles. He hates us. No matter what Trump says or does, I think the bigger picture we need to look at here, guys, is we need to see what we can do to make certain that one of his weapons does not land on U.S. soil. And I think that's what we need to be discussing and get off this stuff about Trump is a bully. By the way, have you read the Wall Street Journal back in 2007, 2008 about Carl Stan and how Hillary Clinton took all this money and Bill Clinton and all his speeches? she really was the bully who bullied Barack Obama. Remember that?
Yeah. Gary, let me go back to the focus of your question. I will let Art defend his response to my first question tonight, but I want to ask you a question, because one thing that came out of our last discussion was that we shouldn't just be talking about military. There's other ways to fight this through cyber attacks and everything else. It would seem to me that if you've got 15 nations that sign off on something in the Security Council, and they don't want North Korea to have nukes, and they really believe that, it would seem to me that the collective cyber abilities of all these nations could be used to thwart any further advancement of the North Korean nuclear program. Is that realistic in your view, Bob?
Well, cyber is putting it pretty narrowly, but the fact of the matter is the 15 we're talking about include China and Russia, who are the most important supporters of North Korea.
Yeah.
So what we did a week ago was really quite a major diplomatic achievement, which is possible then to set as the foundation for policies which really could encourage change. Now, those change might not necessarily be in the cyber attack. The change could be, for instance, to truly open the door to alternative power centers to the Kim regime inside of North Korea. One way to really create trouble for an authoritarian state is to encourage an alternative power center. Could be within the military, could be within the intelligence, it could be within the commercial sectors.
Could be within the family, but he killed his uncle.
Well, so you see, they're worried about this immediately.
Yes,
so the kinds of opportunities... I'm just saying, you're talking about a very narrow one opportunity, but what's happened is we opened the door to multiple opportunities.
Right. Yeah. I meant to say
gentlemen,
that.
Can I talk about that?
Yeah, go ahead, Gary, back to you.
All right, you had mentioned 15 nations. And if I'm hearing you correctly, I think it's a great point. However, will those nations really step up and be the power play we need? Look what happened at that deal that was made in Paris where Trump walked out. I'm not saying that was a good thing or a bad thing. But what was interesting was no other nation really supported us in any of that. I think the United States was the only one that was giving money to that.
But again, we're talking, Gary. We are talking about two different issues here. One is a disagreement over global warming or climate control. The other is whether or not a nation.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about that is the other nations that said they would support us or said they would support this particular entity never did. How do you know
which entity?
North Korea?
I've lost on
the global warming thing.
That's
how
my
do
point.
You know North
they
dis- Korea
what I'm saying is they can disagree on that. They don't necessarily have to disagree on the other. Let me
how
ask
how do you know that though?
Let
guys?
Me ask
you, they don't like
Gary,
us. They don't like us.
Gary, let me ask Colonel the question. Which underscores your question, and that is, of those 15 nations, Gary wants to know how many of them could be counted upon to participate in this massive way to destabilize North Korea, anything below military strike. Do you have confidence that they would actually do
right.
it?
Short answer is the armistice that Art mentioned earlier was an armistice between the United Nations and the belligerent parties, which included North and South Korea. Now, neither North nor South ratified that armistice, but that armistice has been enforced. There is a UN command in Korea, in South Korea, and not a huge, robust military presence. The United Nations needs to approach this in what I'll call the DIME format. So you have the four letters of DIME: diplomatic, information, military, and economic. Last week, the Security Council, 15 nations got together unanimously, and they instituted diplomatic and economic. There is always the potential for the military thrust to resolve a problem. The biggest challenge that we've had, and Bob identified it, is one of information and going into the North Korean populace and finding that weak point. Unlike every other country in the world, North Korea is truly the hermit kingdom. They don't have broadband access for everyone. surreptitious transformation or transition of South Korean movies, news, and entertainment on flash drives and flash discs, that's one way that we're getting information into them. We have to find better and other ways of introducing a informational Stuxnet into the people of North Korea, but it's going to be a tough fight.
When we come back, we're about to break, but when we come back, one of the things that I want to talk about is whether or not having what some people describe as irrational rhetoric from the President of the United States, followed by a UN vote, or Tillerson and the State Department, the National Security Team, doing another thing. So we're sending them two messages. On one hand, we're trying to scare them. On the other hand, we're trying to make a little peace. Back shortly.
Hey, y'all, I'm Blake Shelton. I love that country music connects people all over this great nation, but unfortunately, so does something else, childhood hunger. 15 million children struggle with hunger in America. That's why the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks works to rescue our surplus food to help provide billions of meals to families in need across the country. Join the fight against hunger at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications is Chicago's perfect place for senior citizens. Enjoy a stroll down memory lane. Reminisce as museum artifacts, photos, and classic TV shows trigger recollections from your childhood. Enjoy the TLC you'll receive from our expert tour guides. Discounts for groups of 20 or more. Schedule yours right now at museum.tv or call 312-245-8200. Plan your fun trip now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Bruce Dumont back in Beyond the Beltway. Thanks for joining us tonight, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border. Hopefully we are a regular stop for you every Sunday night. And Ryan Yantis is one of our guests this evening. And during the break, Ryan, you were making the point about the Kim family. We were talking about the irrationality of Kim and the Kim family, but you put it in an entirely different context. So put that on the air.
The Kim family, through the decades, the succession from Kim Sung-il and down to the modern little Kim, it's very rational actions to keep the Kim family safe, secure, and in power, and to keep the apparatus of the North Korean government built to support their success and succession. So whatever they're doing is geared towards their longevity. And if we think that they're trying to be a partner in the community of nations, if we think that they're going to suddenly start acting with Occidental rules and the Western approach to things, we're smoking dope. The other thing that's really hampering us now is the lack of real knowledge of who Kim Jong-un is. Because other than his time in Switzerland when he was in school, then he went back to North Korea and went to the military college, but he was a minor player. He was not a named successor. He didn't come onto the stage, and we don't have those assets for many reasons to understand who that man is and what his real motives are.
Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, said a couple of weeks ago, he said, we're not an enemy of North Korea. We can, basically, he thought we could get along, but you got to give up your weapons. That was his caveat. Mm-hmm. But again, that was part of the olive branch that the administration put forward, and then obviously the vote at the UN followed that, and then the president's rhetoric sort of took it into a different direction. But I'm wondering, and again, I have mentioned this several times over the last couple of years, the likelihood of Dennis Rodman playing some role to tap down the rhetoric. He knows each of the players. And I wonder, how absurd is that thought, Bob Pape?
Well, I don't think in the current moment, given the tensions that have risen, I don't think it would actually help, Bruce. I think that in another kind of a less intense moment here, maybe 6 months from now or a year from now, but at the moment, things are really so tense that I think that what that would do is it would really persuade China, South Korea, Japan, that America really had totally lost it, that we're moving in the wrong direction. However, I do think an alternative that I think would make a lot of sense would be to give Tillerson more of the podium. So what could be a good week here? You know, what would be a good future would be if Tillerson was the face of the policy for the next week. Tillerson was the face of the policy leading up to the UN success. Mm-hmm. This week, not, as you said, Trump now has dominated that. However, Tillerson is the one in the region doing the most traveling, the most face-to-face meetings. And it's also the case that I want to, you know, just sort of really say China's movement toward our position here is not to be underestimated. China's not our best bud here. This isn't Great Britain who moved to our position. So if Tillerson could become the face, maybe, in fact, we can kind of pull a little bit of a rabbit out of a hat here.
What if, and don't scream at me when I suggest this, what if the president and Kim got together personally, just the two of them? You say we don't know him. What if the two? What if Donald Trump said, "You know what? I don't want to bomb them back to the Stone Age. They're already at the Stone Age. I want to talk to this guy."
Now, I think it's a great idea, Bruce.
The reaction of the world, I think, would be they would be horrified.
They might.
The press guy would be horrified.
They might.
I'm not so sure that Trump supporters would be horrified if instead of a nuclear attack that the president of the United States, albeit, you know, some described an irrational actor, sat down with someone else who's been described the same way and let the two guys talk.
During the Reagan administration, Ronald Reagan, who was certainly no friend of the Soviet Union, decided to sit down and meet with Gorbachev. This was a major event. It was a major positive event because that is what allowed Reagan to take the measure of Gorbachev the man and also sent tremendous signals throughout the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc that the United States was not bent on nuclear war with the Soviet Union, which had really been a reality until in the first 2 years of the Reagan administration. So I think this is in the direction of what I'm suggesting, Bruce.
Ryan?
My biggest and the concern that I can think I would hear from folks that I know is, okay, you have the suggestion of the president being in the same room with a young man who ordered the execution with a nerve agent of his older brother.
Yeah.
And has killed family members or had them killed.
Well, we've sat down with murderers before, haven't
well,
we?
Well, we just did with Putin.
Joseph Stalin.
But again, I'm going from... You know, you're asking about Trump supporters, and I think that would be a concern. Just as
whether you think Trump supporters would be upset with that?
Just a concern.
Who cares? We don't care.
What about it, Art? How bizarre is this as a suggestion?
No, we should be thinking outside the box, and probably all of you are better at it than I am. I think the point about criminality and morality that Colonel Yantis makes is important because it is a totally isolated regime, unlike the Soviet Union when Reagan went to see Gorbachev. I also think our unpredictable president, who knows what might, but I think endeavoring to meet with them, providing legitimacy, I think encouraging President Moon of South Korea to continue steps to try to open things with the North is very appropriate. But I want to think about it some more.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to endorse the idea.
As I've said at the beginning of the program, the people that voted for Donald Trump did not want a by the book leader.
Right.
They were fed up. They thought all these things that they're frustrated.
Yeah.
And by the way, North Korea was not a big part of that decision making process. But it's become a big part of the process, even though President Obama left the note for President Trump that North Korea was going to be his biggest problem. And the President Obama was correct in that. We've been talking about that for a number of years here. So my question is, if you're going to think beyond the box, and certainly everyone in the diplomatic corps, they will go crazy that someone meet with someone who's such a despot and wacky and all these other things, they would say that. Many of these people, by the way, say the exact same thing about the president of the United States in private and sometimes in public. And I would say, what do we have to lose? What do we have to lose if President Trump sat down and talked with Kim?
I don't think we have anything to lose. I don't think Trump is going to be bamboozled in that setting by Kim. I also don't think Kim will necessarily be bamboozled by Trump. I think we need to choreograph this in some clever way. I think we have plenty of smart people. General Kelly is plenty smart enough to be able to choreograph such a meeting in a way that might assuage some of those concerns.
Okay. That's our big suggestion from Beyond the Beltway tonight. Let's let the president and Kim Jong-un meet. I'm suggesting a round dinner table right at the DMZ where Kim could sit on his side, the president could sit on his side, and we'd find out who picked up the check.
That's what 1-800-723-8289. Napoleon used to do that.
These are the comments that coming from Beyond the Beltway. You're not going to hear this discussion.
Go home now, right?
The press.
End of the program, right?
I'm back in Chicago, and we got lots of callers on the line. Let's go to line 4. Kelly, listening to us in Athens, Illinois on WMAY. That's in Springfield. Kelly, go ahead. Nice to hear from Central Illinois.
Yeah. Hey, good evening, fellas.
Hi.
Hey, listen, aren't we facing the same scenario we faced in, 62? We've got a rogue nation without provocation, a new nuclear power that has threatened to reach out and kill a million of us. Our nation was in a state of shock at that time. And it was an emergency.
You're talking about Cuba now.
Well, Cuba. I'm talking about the missile coming from across a different ocean.
Yeah, right, from Cuba.
But the missile crisis.
No, but from Korea, from the Pacific. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. What's the difference? Shouldn't we be in a state of shock and on the defensive?
Colonel.
No, I don't think defensive. The difference between the scenario you laid out about the Soviet Union and their client state of Cuba, we knew the Soviets. We had worked with the Soviets throughout World War II. They were an ally up until 45, 46, and then you had the fracturing of relations and that start of the Cold War and the fall of the Iron Curtain as coined by Churchill in his speech in Missouri. But we knew them. We had dossiers on them. We had information about the primary actors in the Politburo and within the government.
The Kelly, back to you.
And we've got a pretty good rundown of what's going on in Korea, didn't we?
No.
We've been dealing with them for years.
We've been dealing with them for years, but we lack the same degree of human intelligence, the knowledge of who the personalities are and what their predictability is. For example, if you want to play poker, you want to know what their tells are, your opponents, when they're going to bluff, when they're going to call, when they're going to lay it out. And that's the same thing on a geopolitical level. The more understanding you have of the individuals.
Kelly, we're going to move on. Thanks for your call. We do appreciate it. There's been some conversation this week in the media about whether or not American intelligence was caught a little flat-footed by the speed with which North Korea has increased their capability.
One of the things that happened just in the last few weeks is that the Defense Intelligence Agency has changed its estimate on the number of nuclear weapons that North Korea has. Up until the last few weeks, we have an estimate in the U.S. government of topping out at around 30 nuclear weapons. They've now increased that to 60 nuclear weapons. And what you see in the last year is a somewhat greater pace of both missile tests and nuclear tests, and not just number of tests, but different types of tests. So North Korea is now testing bombs that are pulsed up a little bit with tritium. It's a kind of gas that increases the yield and boosts the yield of a atomic weapon. And it's an intermediate step toward what's called a hydrogen weapon, which has still even greater yield. And so what you see is that our intelligence agencies caught flat-footed a little harsh here. I think that what's happened is the pace has probably quickened just over the last year with North Korea in both its missile tests and its nuclear tests. And what you're seeing is that the intelligence agencies are now increasing their estimates side by side. So this is, again, something to be quite concerned about the number of nuclear weapons that we could really be dealing with here in North Korea.
All right, let me ask you a follow-up. Because the president has been critical of American intelligence in the past, and there's been difficulty in the communication between the intelligence community and the president has not been solid in the first 6 months of his presidency. Is there some concern that you might have about whether or not the president is going to believe any of the intelligence that might be provided to him, or is he going to rightfully say, wait a minute, you guys were wrong here, or you might be late here. Why should I listen to you now?
That's a very good question. He doesn't listen. Even his friends will say that. And I think you're at the right sticking point. Tension between professional intelligence agencies and political leaders is nothing new, and it continues all the time. Actually, Kelly had a very thought-provoking question in October of 62, with few exceptions, and especially in the CIA. Intelligence types were convinced the Soviets would never do what they had promised not to do, try to sneak missiles into Cuba. It's extremely important to be open-minded. Our own press is, I'm more concerned about the media than intelligence. Quoting the Washington Post, that used to be seen as a reliable source. No more. The New York Times, no more, from my point of view. And that's why Bob's points about specific information emanating from a reliable intelligence source is important. But the biggest problem is the president. He doesn't listen.
Ryan?
I'm going to circle back. Earlier I said the hermit kingdom of North Korea. The totality of how isolated that country is and the lack of human intelligence on the ground, because we can have satellites fly overhead and do all sorts of imagery. We can have other surreptitious information gathering through intelligence of signals and communications, but putting people on the ground. The South Korean people are physically taller, they're stronger, they're bigger than the North Korean counterparts. They speak a different type of Korean, regional, but it's also been influenced by Western words. So getting active agents on the ground is really, really tough in North Korea. And you also have to find that actor within the North Korean government that is willing to give away state secrets.
Risk their lives.
Not only their lives, but there's almost feudal blood of attainder. If you're guilty, Bruce, of treason against the North Koreans, then your children are, your parents are, your cousins, your family is guilty. Going to the camps.
Excuse me, Bob, but we have focused tonight on the fear of their nuclear program and how it might be used against the United States. I want to get everybody's reaction. I'm going to start with you, Bob. Let's talk about their other military strength in the number of people, planes, intelligence, cyber security. I mean, what are the other covert things that they're involved with that could be causing us all kinds of problems of this side of a nuclear attack?
Well, for decades, North Korea has been one of the most accomplished states in the world in professional covert action. You saw this just this year with a nerve gas attack against a member of the Kim family that was viewed as a rival. But this is simply the latest incident going back decades and decades of efforts by North Korea to use small teams to accomplish high-risk missions using very, very deadly weapons. On top of that, North Korea has produced biological and chemical weapons, again, nerve gas. So this is a country which has been basically for decades producing large quantities mass destruction. Before we went into Iraq 15 years ago, I was extremely skeptical Saddam had chemical weapons or biological weapons, and it turned out to be the case because we had so thoroughly been inspecting that country. North Korea is the opposite. North Korea is where we should be extremely concerned about the quantities of chemical and biological weapons and the professional teams of commandos able to use those weapons. And this is also extends, by the way, to the nuclear. So there's a famous picture now on the web your listeners can see of the disco ball. Just Google North Korea disco ball, and you will see a picture of Kim with this small disco-like ball, which is a nuclear bomb. And that bomb could go into, we were just talking earlier, a frigate. It could go into a cargo vessel. It does not have to sit on top of a nuclear missile. That is a perfect type of weapon for a small commando team to basically get to an American city.
Is it too simple to say that when we're talking about enemies of the United States, in the Middle East, we're talking about people who rally around a version or their interpretation of religion and their hatred of the United States. But religion, again, religion is a gathering force of togetherness that brings them together. And they use that fervor to strike out against the United States in their war on terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the world, we have people also devious, maybe even more devious, or certainly equally devious, maybe with connections to powerful supporters, and their passion is survival of their country. It may be allegiance to the Kim family,
mm-hmm.
but it's really about survival of their country. And maybe that's a stronger connective tissue than an alliance or assertion to a higher calling. Am I making sense with my question?
Well,
you look a little perplexed. Did I lose you?
No,
or did
not
I lose
at all.
Myself?
There are broader principles, whether it's religion or a commitment to a family or to a regime, that can lead people to take very, very high costly actions, and those are the kind of action people that would carry out. Attacks with nerve gases, attacks with very, very deadly weapons, because those weapons don't just need to be used with skill. You need to recognize there's some chance the commandos themselves will simply die. And what you are seeing in North Korea is over and over and over again kind of suicide mission that is not quite a suicide mission in the sense of someone blowing themselves up
right.
with a suicide vest, but a mission where individuals are taking extremely high risks for the Kim family and the North Korean regime over and over and over again. And why wouldn't they do that in the face of an American attack?
More dangerous, as you just said, more dangerous than terrorists in the Middle East.
Yes, because of the nerve gas and biological weapons capability.
But they haven't engaged in mass attacks, which argues that deterrence has worked in this case.
They have blown up discos. They have blown up aircraft. So they have gone for
mass attacks against the United States.
And they went after Sony Pictures on cyber attack.
Yeah.
Not very successful.
Yeah, but they haven't used all their
That's not a big deal. 1-800-723-8229. We will continue great discussion this evening. Thanks for being with us. Back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. I mentioned at the beginning of the program we were going to spend a segment talking a little bit about what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend. And again, we'll talk more about that next week on this program. But of course, the video that you've been watching and seeing on television really shows the ugly side of America with the demonstrators. In fact, we've got some of that are shown right now for those watching us on television. It's just the rioting in the streets or the battling in the streets between white supremacists and those that gathered to protest them. And that was in Charlottesville yesterday. And then, of course, also late yesterday, there was the car attack, which some people are describing as a terrorist attack. And this was the car driving into a crowd of anti or protesters. And again, one person died as a result of that, 16 people injured. And again, in response to that, again, we were going to play the president's quote, but the president's quote, which was viewed by some people as being too tepid, his opponents said that it was too tepid. The White House came back with a stronger comment today. But I want to discuss, at least get your response. I'll start with you, Ryan, your reaction to where do we as a nation go that should allow people to have a free expression of their political beliefs, albeit unpopular, and also the right of those to oppose and to protest those positions. How can we have that without violence breaking out? Any suggestions?
You know, the military is an amazingly diverse workplace. You end up working with, for, and around folks you would otherwise never meet in normal day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most diverse workforces is the American Infantry Platoon, where you're forced to live and work alongside with folks, and you use horrible nicknames for each other, and you tease each other without mercy. But at the end of the day, there is that collective mythos of service, that you're in something larger than yourself. And I wish I had a silver bullet answer for your question. We need to remind people that first, last, and always, they're Americans. If they want to be hyphen American at the beginning, that's fine, but it's American. So those 10 basic Bill of Rights amendment that protect you, they protect other folks as well. And you may not like what they say or do. Let them have their turn to say, refute their positions with facts, refute their positions with realities. When you resort to violence, you've lost something. So in it was a horrific attack. Mm-hmm. It was pointless. It is a tragedy that people died and were injured, and it doesn't move the agenda forward for either side.
Bob Pape, your reaction.
It's an act. The car going into the people, that was done with a political motive in mind. Mm-hmm. Political violence, politically motivated violence, that is what we call terrorism. So it is not done by a terrorist group.
It's not a misuse of the name.
It's not a misuse of the name. What we mean by terrorism is politically motivated violence, and that is an act. Now, to be clear, this is not an act of an individual who's part of some larger organization that is carrying out a series or campaigns or intends to carry out a campaign.
That we know yet.
That we know yet.
Yes.
However, we should be aware that in many parts of the world, we see this all the time, that terrorist groups begin as a manifestation of violence in ordinary protests. And this is not, we are not immune to this somehow because we're Americans. This is why it's incredibly important that the President of the United States, not just people in the White House, but the President of the United States, announce and take extremely strong action. The President certainly knows how to take strong action and knows how to vocalize this. We're just talking about this with North Korea. The fact that President Trump is not saying this is as loud as his words are soft. Well, it's very important.
It's not as loud. At least the initial response was not as loud and articulate as his many people thought that it should be, including many Republicans. Art, I want to get your reaction to the issue of those people who have the right to, you have a right to be a white supremacist in this country. You have a right to do that.
Yeah.
You also have a right to protest against them. How can both of those things exist without the violence of Charlottesville?
By enforcing the rule of law and making very clear that the First Amendment is a basic fundamental right in this country and not in other countries, not in Great Britain and elsewhere. Things like this underscore the importance of the First Amendment. In academia today, we hear a lot and talk a lot about diversity. My biased opinion is it's often used in an Orwellian sense. I'm not exaggerating. We want conformity. Tolerance is you toeing the line with me, you not showing a flag that I disapprove of. It's more important than ever that we protect the First Amendment. It also shows the power of the media. The 24/7 global news cycle, if you do a terrible, despicable act, suddenly you can become a global celebrity, at least for 15 minutes or so. And I'm not being glib about it. It shows the tremendous importance of the media. Finally, crime, violent crime, has declined drastically in this country since the early 90s. From the 50s into the 90s, we had gigantic crime waves in America for reasons no one can fully explain. We are not a violent country, which is one reason why life is punctuated so much by this kind of incident.
But there are also outliers like Chicago and the violence that we have in Chicago.
All right, fair enough. In certain sectors of Chicago.
It may not be the 1920s or 30s in Al Capone, but it's not good as well. The principal challenge and criticism of the president was, I think, the term when he said there's been violence. He denounced violence on all sides. And then he said, repeat it, on all sides. Does everyone agree that that was the most egregious thing he said? Or if you are a observer of what happens in the world, when you see violence in California against those who against colleges and universities, there's violence. It is violence of the left. Some are anarchists. Some are I don't want to describe them as Democrats, but some of those are certainly anti-government. Mm-hmm. I mean, the violence is on the left and the right. And the president seems to have been, castigated for including that in his in his statement. Was the statement accurate, or was the timing of the statement wrong?
Well, it's not so much about the timing. It's about whether or not the president is really willing to stand up and tell his own supporters they're wrong. And by trying to have a balanced statement, unfortunately,
assuming that they are his supporters.
Well,
now, again, there were those.
That's true.
David Duke obviously talks about Donald Trump, and there were other people. There were signs there that suggested these were Trump supporters.
That's true. Assuming
even though
that,
he denounced them during the campaign.
That's exactly
he took
right.
Their votes.
But what's at issue here is whether the president will say no to his own supporters. And unfortunately, when the president issued this balanced statement, what that's doing is it's sending a message that maybe the president won't say no to his own specific supporters when they cross the line.
There was a stronger statement that did come out today.
From the White House, not from the president.
It wasn't the initial statement. And I would say, and again, I've given the president the benefit of the doubt on this program many times, but also I will say, whenever you see, whether it's Donald Trump or anyone, when you see them looking down and reading a card, it's not their true opinion. Donald Trump was not looking down at any card when he was talking about Kim Jong-un and when fire and fury. He wasn't looking down anywhere. When he talked about what was going to happen in Guam, when he talked about being that the United States was not going to just sit by and let Kim Jong-un just, rattle on. He looks at camera. He tells you exactly what he thinks. Sometimes it infuriates a lot of people. Sometimes it makes a lot of people feel very good about it. But when Donald Trump is speaking that way, he's speaking from the heart, and it's coming out the mouth. It may not be going through the head. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But in this particular case, you should not have to look down at an index card to express the outrage of anyone in America who violates our abilities in this country. What we should be celebrating is that we can have disagreements, we can have protests, but they should not lead to violence. And that bigotry is a bad idea. It's badly expressed. It's badly expressed in all ways. There should be no wiggle room at all about denouncing bigotry and anti-Semitic, racist, white supremacist is the better term, attitudes. There should be no room for it. And again, I don't think you need a speechwriter, and you shouldn't need 24 hours to figure out what you should be saying. Just as clearly as that just comes out of your mouth, it should come out of your mouth. If you really believed it. And that brings up the question as to whether or not there was a political motive to this, and is it being used by those that oppose the president to create some problems, to create some, rift between the president and the people that support him that may have similar beliefs? Or, as some people have expressed today, because Steve Bannon comes from the alt-right and has been an effective person for the president, is this a way to separate and push Steve Bannon out of the White House? That's sort of intrigue, White House intrigue now. But again, these are the things. I mean, there is a political calculation here. And the question is, how important are those votes within the totality of the 62 million people that elected Donald Trump president of the United States?
And I would just add to that very fine statement, Bruce, the trajectory over the last 6 months since Donald Trump has come into office. You might remember the first month, there were protests at Berkeley, there were protests at Middlebury that ended in fistfights.
I've got to interrupt you.
Now we have a death.
Yeah. Back shortly and thanks for joining us today. Back in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. Let's go to Greg in Schaumburg, listening to us on CGO, our affiliate and flagship in Chicago. Go ahead, Greg. You've been waiting a long time.
Thanks for taking my call, Bruce. Incidentally, a quick interjection. I think you nailed the solution to this about 45 minutes ago when you suggested putting Trump and Kim in a scenario together. Because
yes.
Every single person who has gone in to see Trump, who had negative things to say about him, think of all those people trumping up to the Trump Tower before the election, came out and said that he's a very nice guy, man of his word, and they really liked him. So I would not discount that. But here's the reason for my call, though. And see this as a friendly missile aimed at you, Mr. Professor Sear. Okay, throughout the entire conversation, you guys have criticized Trump essentially on his wording of things, his ability to use words. But yet you said there's probably a multidimensional strategy in place that we have. So let's assume that that's the case, that we've got all of those strategies in place. Why is it not a legitimate stance, given the fact that guys sending missiles into the ocean that are designed to hit Guam, a legitimate point for Trump's words to be recognized as a valid strategic element in this? And my second question is,
let's let him respond to the first question first, Greg. Go ahead.
Okay.
We've talked about Secretary Tillerson more than once. Immediately after the UN vote, he was in the Philippines for a very important meeting of ASEAN, and then he made a point of landing at Guam and spending some time there on the way back home. I believe President Trump has picked some extremely talented and able people, a lot but not all of them military, and that dynamic, I think, will continue to be more and more important.
So I would just add to what
I appreciate your interest in my remarks. Thank you very much.
And I would just add, if you go and look at the chronology, sir, you'll see that it was Trump's fire and fury rhetoric which then led Kim to threaten the Kim regime to threaten Guam, not the other way around. Mm-hmm. So what did not happen here is Kim made a out and out threat to Guam, and then Trump is defending us. No, Trump upped the ante.
I don't buy that.
Okay, go ahead.
No, well, it's just simply a matter of history.
Go ahead, Greg.
He has been sending missiles out of that country routinely every other week. Don't nuance things like that. We're getting tired of that in this country. So here's my second question, and let's just get to the gentleman who was just speaking. Okay, so if Trump has the people come to him this week and says Kim has just launched and it's looking like it's heading toward Guam, what do you want him to do?
Oh,
okay.
We're going to do everything we can to shoot it down. We would certainly do everything we could to shoot it down, sir.
Let me frame up the question.
And attack North Korea as well. No, that's an idea.
Go ahead, Greg.
Wait a minute. Let me frame up the question, please, and then you can speak. What I'm saying is, with the nuance that you have done to Trump's language and his position, if it hits outside of a 30-mile radius and doesn't hit Guam, is he going to be criticized by you the next week for not taking action? Or does it have to be a direct strike? What is it with you people?
Let's let him respond.
Given the situation we're at right now, Tuesday is going to be a very interesting day. So Tuesday is the deadline. That is when Kim's people have said they're going to give the decision to the Kim to. And I think if Kim were to launch anything on Tuesday, as long as it launches, it is going to be shot down instantly. And I would support that because we don't know what is going to be on the on top of that missile. And we're not going to wait to see where it goes. I think that this is, however, a problem because just because those missiles come up and we try to shoot them down doesn't mean they're actually going to be the main way they would deliver a nuclear warhead on us.
One other point to remember, and then we're going to move on, Greg. This goes back several months when the United States was sending some destroyers into that part of the world. Kim said he was going to attack the destroyers. He said that. Got a lot of publicity. And he didn't. The destroyers kept coming, and he did not destroy them. So you know his mouth can run a little crazy as well. Greg, we've got to move on. Ryan, quick question to you.
And Bob hit a point. It's Tuesday is the decision point for the Kim regime, but that also happens to be a very important anniversary. It's the Liberation Day when the Koreas stepped away from Japanese occupation and control. So there's just like they did the missile test on the 4th of July, and they did a second one at the end of July. Now you have another evocative holiday in the North Korean mythos This was the time when Kim Sung-il liberated North Korea from the evil Japanese.
Good point.
They look for that mythology in helping their control of the North.
All right, let's go to Mark in Monterey, California, listening to us on KION.
Hey, Bruce, thanks very much. Just wanted to point out a double standard that we have here in the media reaction to what Trump said or didn't say yesterday. When we have an instance where a right-wing group or an alt-right group does something, you know, absolutely terrible, there's always this media rush and frenzy to go to a Republican president and say, you've got to denounce this in the strongest of terms. Yet on the other hand, when we have Democrat presidents and left-wing groups commit horrible acts, there is never that same pressure saying, you know, Mr. Obama or Mr. Clinton, stand up and denounce these left-wing groups in the strongest of terms. So, why should Trump denounce
or in Ferguson?
Or Ferguson, exactly. You know, there is never, it's a double standard, and I'd like your guest to address that.
I watch Fox News, I watch CNN, I flip back and forth, sir. I don't see a double standard. I see one show is criticizing the Republicans, one show criticizing the Democrats. So it's I just don't buy this argument that we live in a world where the news media only criticizes one. I think we live in a world where if you look at the millions who watch each of those two shows, you'll see that it's pretty balanced. Both sides get criticized.
No, I beg to differ.
All right, Mark, we're running out of time, but I beg to differ is something that we've heard from our callers tonight on a couple of our guests in studio, and that's what Beyond the Beltway is all about. We have experts. We have people calling from coast to coast and border to border. You don't have to agree with all the experts we have here because who knows? Are they really experts? Well, they are. They are. They're credentialed, but, you know, credentialed experts have been wrong in the past, right, Art?
Absolutely, Bruce.
Absolutely, but not
You're
necessarily.
Right. You're always
necessarily.
Right.
But again, the big news out of tonight's show is that I have called for a meeting with President and Kim Jong-un. Let's see what happens. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.